Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, or good morning, depending on where you are. Welcome to Talk with Tenny. I had my official first screw-up today, trying to get the show on the air, and so I've broadcasting at 3 a.m. So if you're out there listening and looking to talk to somebody, give me a call and let's talk. So I had originally today anticipated on doing two different things. First was a show on trans experience and people of trans experience talking about different ways that they've either been forced into psychiatric treatment or had medical access denied to them. And I think that these are really urgent issues that we need to be exploring and about how psychiatry controls gender and sexuality. So that was originally supposed to be the show that was going to run tonight from 8 to 10, and I hope that MJ Eckhouse and Lester Cook will be able to come on the show again in sometime in the near future, and I apologize deeply for that. One of the other things that was going to happen tonight was an urgent report about what I think is really a national epidemic of people with psychiatric histories being killed or dying in or on their way to psychiatric involvement. There have been a couple of stories in the news in the last few days that have really jarred me, and I think in part, I'm not sure why these things happen, but several weeks ago I had gotten a call from somebody anonymously about a death at the Nathan Kline Institute in Rockland County, New York, Rockland County Psychiatric Center. So the New York State Office of Mental Health operates multiple state-operated facilities, and one of them is Rockland Psychiatric Center in Rockland, New York. And the New York State Office of Mental Health also operates two research institutes, and one of these research institutes is the Nathan Kline Institute, where this death of a 51-year-old man named Scott Jones was reported to me, which is always a disturbing thing. And I think that we need to, if we know about any kind of human rights violations or deaths that are occurring inside of psychiatric systems, we need to start cataloging them, I think, and so that the public can start to see how many people are dying at the hands of psychiatry. I've got somebody who's here trying to chat with me about them defunding psychiatric facilities. And that's true. Deinstitutionalization in many ways has been an effective thing. And so now I'm trying to type and talk at the same time. Okay, I'm gonna get this. This is only, 5 days in? I'd like everybody to know we've had, a really great response from people coming in. Okay, so the Nathan Kline Institute, I'm sorry if this gets a little disjointed. The Nathan Kline Institute, where this death was reported to me, I was told was on the CREF unit, C-R-E-F. And I didn't know what that was, and so today I went looking, and so the CREF stands for the Clinical Research and Evaluation Facility Unit, and the person who reported this wasn't aware that this unit was a research facility. So perhaps it's not part of the research facility, and it just happens to be housed in the research institute on a unit called Clinical Research and Evaluation Facility. So one of the things that really I think needs to happen is obviously in addition to an investigation into the death of Scott Jones, who I was told was a very sweet and quiet man, also whether or not people who are in the Nathan Kline Institute as participants in research or what would traditionally be called human subjects, are aware with informed consent and willing to be part of any research that is happening in these places. I think this is utterly, utterly important. This person is just now asking me if I'm talking about the case of Bradley Bollard. He was at Rikers and died 7 days in solitary with no medication. Bradley Bollard is one of the people that I definitely intended on talking about tonight. He was a 39-year-old man, and in September, after 7 days in solitary confinement, which he was in solitary confinement for making a lewd gesture at a female guard for 7 days, he was found. He was found dead in the cell, and under terrible conditions. And with a sepsis, with an infection so bad that it partially killed him. So I think that this is, just one more of the people that we were going to be talking tonight. So Scott Jones, Bradley Bollard, Michael Blair, a 26-year-old man, in Fort Bend, Texas, on November 4th, 2013, was in his family's home. He was apparently having a real struggle and contemplating or acting on suicide. It's not clear to me what that is, what his particular situation was. But what is clear is that the family had called the hospital for assistance, and the hospital called 911. The hospital told them to call 911, and the family was hesitant about calling 911. And so somebody set up a hidden cell phone camera, and miraculously it was the exact right angle to capture what I'm calling Michael Blair's murder. And within under 5 minutes, it was all over, and he was shot at 11 times, and a shot that killed him went to his head. I think somebody's telling me to go slower and to breathe. I know you're listening, and I thank you for listening. And they have, this is part of the problem. Jerome Merdeau is another person who is a former Marine who is also at, I believe, Rikers, 56 years old. The news headline was that he, quote, baked to death in a 101-degree cell where he was found dead. And then Darren Rainey, 50 years old, on June 23rd, 2012, in Florida, I can't even talk about this. This is also disturbing. He was, what the article had said, cooked to death. And he was being punished by the guards, and the camera, the video camera somehow malfunctions during this, but he was being punished for defecating in his cell and not cleaning it up. And his punishment was to be in a small, tiny shower cell with scalding hot water being, blasted on him. And at 50 years old, he died on June 23rd in that shower stall. So I think that when we really start to look at how when the children who were drugging and restraining and killing, you know, if the drugs don't kill them and if they don't perish as children, like Rebecca Riley or others, children who have died at the hands of psychiatry, by the time they get to be adults, we certainly are. I also really want to make sure that I mention Kelly Thomas's brutal beating and being tasered about this. And so, yeah, somebody just texted me that they said that Mr. Rainey, Darren Rainey's skin was so burnt that it was falling off, and they termed it slippage. It's horrifying of what when people are in position of power, how easy it is for them to abuse that power. And being in a culture where these kinds of things are permitted and seen as acceptable. As an example, after I watched the Michael Blair video, I really lost it there, because you literally are seeing somebody be killed, first of all, and so that's always, I guess, a jarring thing and not something in my general experience. And then it's realizing that, you know, they were there because they were trying to stop him from killing himself, and that there was just, you know, no humanity at all. That there is just no humanity, and the arrogance and the demand for respect. And I want to say, you know, I'm somebody who respects police. I've always had good relationships with police. Police, in my activism, have been fabulous and supportive of what it is we're doing. And I think it's because they're out there and they see what's going on and they're involved in this, and they understand that, like, psychiatry isn't necessarily the best way to go about these things. That's just my assumption as to why they've always been so helpful with organizing protests and activism and things like that that I've been involved with. But for some reason, when the call is for somebody who's having some kind of extreme emotional crisis, the response becomes an immediate demand to one's authority. And I'd like to acknowledge that my experience is, you know, I constantly have to remember that everybody doesn't know me. And I know that if I wasn't a, 42-year-old white woman, that my experience may not be the same, and that there are plenty of people who have not had good experiences with police, and that this is a large issue. And I want to make sure that people realize that I realize that. But the arrogance of these police, and Philip Zimbardo showed it. He showed it. They showed it in the Stanford Prison Study. They showed it in Abu Ghraib. They've showed that this is a problem that happens in these kinds of places, but that it's more than Zimbardo says something like, it's not looking at the bad apple. It's not even looking at the bad barrel. It's looking at the bad barrel maker, and we're locating where the power is. And we keep on going to trying to fix the problem by finding and targeting individuals based on this very subjective criteria of what is psychiatric. And that is putting an entire populace of people in risk of a 25 to 30 year shortened span of life, barring all of these, you know, incidences of violence like I've just talked about tonight, and like with Michael Blair or Darren Rainey. And that anybody is at risk. All you need is for somebody to even suspect that you have some kind of problem, and immediately you can become suspect. And that's that's a very unreal sounding kind of place for most people who haven't experienced psychiatry. If you would like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. I think that you know, part of where we need to be going with this is how do we build communities, and at the same time, how can we be honest about what psychiatry can and cannot do? And for somebody with informed choice who wants to be involved with this, do with that whatever drugs you want to do. But people need to realize that these are drugs, and that these drugs aren't going to solve problems that are economic or political or social or things like housing. You know, a drug is not, you know, as Joe says, you know, so here's a pill. Well, how do you live in a pill? And I think that that's really an important thing for people to realize, is that while we're rushing people over to psychiatry, if they don't wind up getting killed in the process of being brought into an institution, you know, I don't know how to, for people who I have these conversations with who you know, rebuttal what it is that the Mental Patients Liberation Movement and the human rights movement for people in mental health have been talking about for not only decades in the modern movement since the 1970s, late 60s, but also for centuries. The psychiatric survivor movement goes back literally for centuries. And so how do you get society to pay attention? Because what happens most ordinarily, from what I've been able to figure out in my research, is that things get absolutely awful. Somebody goes in and puts a spotlight on what's happening. Society, when they learn what is actually happening to these people who are in these places, becomes infuriated and decides that people need to be treated better. And so they change the name of what they're doing, and they continue to do basically the same thing that they did before, except each time they try further and further to make it sound like it's science. And so from a leucotomy to a lobotomy to psychosurgery to neurosurgery for psychiatric disabilities, we're still doing the same thing, attempting to destroy the brain in order to outroot some undesirable traits in people. And this is absolutely the largest issue that we need to face, is having general society understand that that people who get assigned a psychiatric label are people and have human and civil and constitutional rights, and that if you think it can't happen to you, you're wrong. Especially if, you know, like the 99% of us, you're living economically struggling, well, maybe not the 99% of us, but a good deal of us, struggling and not being able to have your basic necessities of life paid. So if you can't pay your rent, then you immediately, what was okay when you were paying your rent, now becomes behaviors that are suspicious. And the emotional crisis that economic crises cause is very significant for people. And it doesn't take very much more than that in order to have psychiatry bring you in for 72 hours to evaluate you and determine whether or not you need to be institutionalized or not. And very often, we don't know how often, I can't say very often, but at least every now and then on video, some horrific action is captured that we don't know how often actually happens because the state and the federal government does not release death numbers and causes like they did in the 19th century. And so we've learned that one of the best ways to get a state to comply or providers to comply with a state regulation is by continually asking them to report their numbers, because then they get, you would like to think they get embarrassed, but they wind up getting financial penalty if they don't meet things and stuff like that. And so if we're not even asking people how many people are dying in these institutions in through these psychiatric services, in interactions with authorities, how can we have any justifiable answer of saying, well, this is the random thing, because nobody is giving us what the actual numbers are. And so an economic situation, the loss of a job, and then the fear of the loss of housing is what caused Ms. Esmond Elizabeth Green to go to her pastor in 2008, in July of 2008, because she was very concerned about her situation. And her pastor didn't know what else to do, so she called 911. And Ms. Green was left in the emergency room and in the psychiatric emergency room for 24 hours and dropped to the floor and was ignored and died of a blood clot in the emergency room. and the inhumane way in which she was treated because guards and everybody had been occasionally peeking into the room and seeing this woman laying face down on the floor. So first of all, like, you have to ask yourself why in an emergency room would a security guard or other medical professional not be freaking out if they saw somebody laying face down on the floor in their room, unless it was a common thing for me to happen. And so first we have this thing that may be a common thing of happening of people passed out on a floor face down. And then when they realized that she wouldn't get up when somebody tried to get her up, and they realized she wouldn't get up, the nurse, the way it first started was that the nurse walked over her and she kicked her, like, with her foot, like, prodded her and was like, get up. And then when she didn't move, then they realized that she was dead, and they brought in emergency carts and then covered up the records and wrote other things about what was actually happening. Like, she was, they said that she was sitting quietly or something, that she was up and going to the bathroom when she was, like, literally captured on video camera, writhing on the floor, dying. And they were already under federal investigation, Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency Room. This is where June 19th we're going to be having the 6th annual demonstration and vigil in remembrance of Esmond Green and all others who have been murdered or died because of psychiatry. And so I really am encouraging people to speak out and get involved. The area code is 267-521-0167. If you're out there listening and want to call in, 267-521-0167. So I did with the Michael Blair murder, which has not been legally called a murder. I have found out a little bit more information about this. And so today, well, not today anymore, yesterday, Friday, I spoke with the district attorney who informed me that that it is possible that in late June that the grand jury may be reconvened, but he really couldn't tell me anything about evidence that was given or not given or anything to that degree. He did invite me to call him back on June 13th to discuss, and, you know, and I told him that I would be reporting that tonight, and that, you know, and that people are concerned, and people are concerned, and people should be concerned. You know, the idea that 11 shots to somebody who is standing in the bathroom, in their family's bathroom, with a knife, which I'm not I mean, you got to understand. I understand this, and first coming at somebody who's in that space with a knife, and well, the person with a knife with a gun. How do you compare a knife and a gun? And then you have at least three or four police officers walk, or some type of uniformed men walking in and around there. In this little tiny space, how can you tell me that you need to fire point blank 11 shots at somebody who's standing in a bathtub looking like trying to grab balance because he's just been repeatedly tasered? And for the captain at the county police department, for, you know, that I asked, like, do you stand by this? And yes, ma'am, I do. And that what they're calling it is a justified shooting. And I just don't see how, if we're living in a society like this, that anybody can say that this is a justified shooting. Caller 202, if you're there, join in any time you like.
Hello, Lauren?
Yes.
This is Yvonne Smith. I just woke up and tuned into the show, and I heard your last comments for the last 2 minutes. In fact, I viewed the video. And I was appalled at the comments that I saw on YouTube. But I sort of kind of understand it. At first, I thought this was the guy's front door that they were coming in, and I don't really understand. I have been mixed for years about involving the police when you have what they call a psychiatric emergency. I don't understand why once they shot the guy the first time, why did they have to shoot him 10, 12 times?
How is that justified?
Well, I'm going to say how, because we have this. The same thing happened, I could see from this, the same thing happened in a lot of other cases where there's shootings with the police, whether they're psychiatric or not. I don't know about law in Texas, but I know where I am, and it's different from state to state. It's almost like we have given up our rights to the police once a police officer is involved. And a lot of times family members do not understand this when they call 911, when they call mental health emergency, and what they say on the line is that you get a recording, this is an emergency, call 911. Because what it is, it's a license to kill. And that's how you have to look at it, it's a license to kill. Once, and I'm not agreeing with it in any way, shape, or form, once you have police involved, if the person does not obey their command, absolutely, then it's a license to kill. And so I don't know very much about it other than what I saw on the YouTube and what you said about it is that families call for help. I don't think they call to have their son or husband killed.
No, and Yvonne, the family had already called the hospital, and the hospital told them to call 911. And because the family was unsure about this and didn't trust it, they set up the hidden camera. And that's how the entire thing happened, to be all on the right angle. And so it's another case of where the institution and the system is pushing people to the criminal system. And I, you know, I said today to the district attorney, I was like, it's a knife. How can you put a knife up against a gun? Like, why isn't there some kind of chainmail that the officer could have put on and taken the knife out of the man's hand? Do you know what I mean? If he didn't start with banging on the door.
But it goes back to the I call it the unholy alliance that some people started many years ago. And they were thinking of maybe, I think this started out of Tennessee. They're thinking of a small town maybe, or a rural area where the sheriff is like Bonnie Fife, not Bonnie Fife, like Andy Mayberry, where they know everybody and they have to do multiple services. The police are used to dealing with bad people. They have no counseling or mental health training whatsoever. Maybe somebody may have had some kind of mental health sensitivity. But when they're called like that, and that's the unholy alliance that mental health does with the police. And so, therefore, they tell the people, if this is an emergency, call 911. And they call 911, and this is what they get. I mean, we have this to happen not only with someone in their home. You have this happen with homeless people. In other words, you have said this person is not really in need of medical help, but there is a dangerous situation. And a dangerous situation, I mean, if you've got somebody who is suicidal and they're knocking down the door and you've got people with guns in it, I mean, I would be definitely frightened.
How could you not be frightened? How could you? And I understand. I understand that I need to understand the Texas law better, but it definitely has that level of, if you feel like you're in jeopardy of your life, then you're free to use deadly force, kind of thing. Sorry, go ahead.
This is why everyone should be frightened of involvement in medical issues. Of the police like this, because they would have to have, I understand the guy had a gun. That gun hit a knife, but I'm just saying, why did they have to shoot him 10 or 12 times? Why, once that he was down on the ground, and you had...
And it was because it was rapid succession. It was rapid succession because the officer was out of control. The officer, from the very start, right before he started banging on the door, he looked at his watch like he was aggravated that he had to be there. And when Michael opened the door, he was able to see that he had a knife. And then there was a quick succession of doors slamming and opening and such. And then when the door slammed, he drew his gun and he kicked open the door holding his gun, screaming to put the knife down. And then they began tasing him.
He did die, right? This was a murder, right?
That's what I'm calling it. The Fort Bend County Police told me that it was a justified shooting. And the district attorney suggested to me that there may be a reconvening of a grand jury in late June. So how the person who told me this, who is in a high power position, that it was a justified shooting, they need training throughout the entire thing. Now, I was informed that Texas has some kind of grant coming in to do crisis intervention training, but that leads right back to the same problem, that they're going to be trained into the idea that it's okay to force people into psychiatry.
Lauren, the whole thing about this thing is that, like I said, I made a thing about the unholy alliance. You cannot give somebody some training in 1 week in dealing with these situations, because I've seen this happened where I live. We had a case here, and it happens often. There's a policy where I live in Washington, D.C., that actually they use the police to transport people. So I have had people to call me when they're in the car of the police and say, well, we have something called CPAP, which is Comprehensive Psychiatric Emergency, where they take somebody somewhere and they decide whether they're going to send them to a hospital, let them go, or hold them for a few hours. And they use the police. They have mobile crisis, but they use the police because they don't always have someone that's available. And the policy actually is to transport the person with the police. And I know of one case personally where the person was a 300-pound man. It was in the Washington Post. They had the guy to come. The family members said they didn't know the man had a mental health problem. The man didn't want to go with them. See, the first thing is, once the police are involved in some jurisdictions, I think Texas is probably like D.C., once the police tell you to do something, if you fail to do it, if you fail to move timely, then it's that you have, it's almost like an attack on the police, and they can do anything to you. So he died during this fray. Whether it was that a chokehold or whatever else, but he died. There was a 2 or 3 sentence thing in the Washington Post. Someone else had called me and told me about it. I wrote to the writers. They did some follow-up, and there was a little bit larger story on it. But usually these kind of things that happen largely don't get front-page news because of the way the training is for the police. You say that they're going to have CI, some kind of crisis intervention training. But what the training really does, it really helps them just identify whether a person is mentally ill. They go into great detail of trying to give them examples of if you're out on the street, you can tell that this person, has a mental illness or not. They don't talk about, maybe the person might have a diabetic reaction or whatever else. So I really think that when they have these emergencies like that, that many times they escalate the person to do this. I mean, I think that the family members really wanted some help probably in this case, but they really didn't call for the police to come. They wanted some psychiatric help, and usually in these cases, it's not like, in other words, it's not like all of a sudden.
Right, they were refused psychiatric help. They called for psychiatric help. Psychiatric help said no, call the police.
Well, the big family members really should be suing what happened.
Oh, yeah.
They should be suing the mental health system for failing to get served. This is why I am against assisted outpatient treatment, because as I tell people, and I'm going to have a piece to come out soon on this, AOT is not a service. It's a judicial or legal proceeding. And as you see, when you involve law enforcement in them, what you have done is you've given the people a license to kill, that this person has, you have no rights. You must submit. And you said that the people that you talked to said this was justifiable. I saw some of the comments on the YouTube, and I urge people to go to the, and I know you'll probably give it during this radio program, go to the YouTube site and view the film. And I said, once the person is down on the ground, I mean, the first two shots, there was a long space between it. If you've got more than one person there, why could they not have gotten the gun away from him? Why did they have to?
He didn't have a gun. He had a knife.
He
didn't have a gun. He had a knife.
Yeah, well, he had a knife. They had a gun. Why, after they shot him the first time, why did they have to shoot him? Yeah, I mean, quite sure that they're over him. Why did they have to shoot him those many times? I know this family is probably in anguish, and other people that are seeing this, they should fault the mental health system for not coming to the aid of this person 2 days before, 2 weeks before, for getting help. Why is it that the police are even involved? And having CIT come in these situations, it's going to only have for more, I call it marking, people who have mental health issues.
I fully agree with you. I fully agree with you. I was given that information as if it was supposed to console me. And I was like, no, that doesn't make it any better. Like, exasperates the problem.
Usually what happens is when they have this train to come in, they don't have the full training. What they do is, and I don't know what they're going to do in Texas, because we have a program like this here. They use the CIT model, the name. But in a real CIT, they would have, the police would have ride along with peers and family members. I doubt if that in that situation there was any family member or peer. And it's impossible in a large police force to have ride-alongs with each and every unit, because you cannot be sure that the person who comes out has had this training. The only way that even you can have some kind of degree of uniformity is to have the training in the police academy, and that's not going to happen because the police officer is not going to get credit for that. As you said, the guy was looking at his watch. They don't like to get mental health calls like this because they don't get any points for that. They're called because they're looking for a dangerous person. So you call me out, you're a police officer, and you say they're going to ask questions, even when the dispatcher is going to ask questions. It forces the family members to lie to get assistance. They have to say that the person threatened them or something else. And in this case, the guy had a knife, but like you said, in no way, once one or two shots, and I think I could hear at least 10 shots in this case, and they were already in the bathroom, as they described.
The whole thing was in the bathroom. The news reported 11 shots.
Mm. Well,
11 shots.
Well, unfortunately, this is just one of many cases, and I don't want to say this. This is just one of many cases, and if you have, I had an instance where this year, a week and a half ago, where police came to my house, knocked on my door because of a dispute I had with a neighbor about noise, and I was the person that was asking for help. The police, and I thought about not answering the door, but I opened the door. I told the police what the situation was. They went away. But suppose I had said, and someone had made known to them that I had a mental health history, and I had not opened the door. The thing about it says one thing is, even in the privacy of your own home, you don't have the right not to engage the police. So once they're called, if you're in your own bathroom or whatever else, you give up the right to say, just go away and leave me alone. But this is going to be the case. We're going to have databases set up because the police now will know who is a person who has a mental health issue. And if they're called, it's going to be, like I said, a license to kill. And I'm so glad that you're keeping track of these cases, and I would urge other people to somehow keep track of the cases like this that are happening in their state, because there may be a pattern. There is a, it seems to be a lot of notion in the press and otherwise to kind of demonize people who have mental health issues as sort of like roaches. And we have been having killings. This is just the one that we know about it. Or like the instance I gave you where the person came with a chokehold. And we're probably going to see more and more as people become, as law enforcement becomes more involved in mental health issues. And people really should demand that their mental health systems be held accountable and that they not use law enforcement.
I think that that is absolutely imperative, and that there's that they need to be accountable, and the unholy alliance, as you put it, I think that that's great, Yvonne. It really is, and I think also once the Affordable Care Act kicks in, and everybody starts to realize that they are going to be screened for mental health issues and all of this kind of stuff, and it's going to reach out to more and more people. I sat in meetings 10, 12 years ago where they decided that the way to get rid of the quote-unquote stigma of, you know, psychiatric labels is to give everybody a label. And I didn't last much longer after that, actually. But
the family members, family members on this, has anyone heard or either seen articles or comments from the local TV station that the family members of these martyred individuals?
I'm sorry, of the family members, I lost you there for a second.
You had said that the family members had called asking for help. I was wondering after these, after their family members were killed, I don't know, you may not know if the family members are suing or have they had any reaction to this. Were they thankful to the police or were they
appalled? No, they were screaming, you killed him. You killed him. They were screaming for God and saying, you killed him. I myself have not been in touch, but I've attempted to get in touch with people who were representing them. And I'm hoping that with continued communication with others that I will be able to actually get in touch with the family and let them know of the support from many of us in the human rights movement and the psychiatric survivor movement and others who are our allies and or identify themselves in other ways.
Should be gathered and shown to people because I think what happens is they didn't intend for this to happen, but
But they were nervous. They were nervous about it, and that's why they set up the hidden camera. So they not only because they wanted help from the system, the psychiatric system, and the psychiatric system refused them, and this is exactly what happened with Andrew Goldstein, who killed Kendra Webdale, which is what created the New York involuntary outpatient commitment laws. You know, that dozens of times he reached out for help. He was refused by mental health professionals repeatedly. And then, you know, it got to the point of where a tragedy occurred. And so it's not people who are refusing treatment. It's people who are calling for assistance and being refused.
This is the bad thing about the legislation that's happening with the Murphy bill because even assisted outpatient treatment, it is not. I had to argue with someone last week, and they said, Yvonne, I didn't know. They said, well, what are you going to do with people that don't want to go into treatment? I said, well, one thing, if they're right, we do have, in all states, they have commitment laws. If a person is sufficiently dangerous, that they can go in. But the fact is that AOT is not a service. It's a judicial procedure, and the mental health system does what they do is they pass it off to law enforcement, and instead of having what I foresee having, instead of having more people getting more treatment, what will happen is more and more people will be either locked up or if we have enough killings, and if the news media, which I think has done a piss-poor job of reporting on these killings and maimings, that people will flee even trying to get assistance because they will be marked. And I don't know why.
Yvonne.
Hmm.
Sorry, no, go ahead. You don't know why?
I don't know why people are so insistent about this AOT, assisted outpatient treatment, which is not really treatment at all, because it will just further expand the killings like this, because the police will eventually have a database of people who are labeled mentally ill. I mean, this
right.
is what's going
to
happen.
And New York, New York Safe Act, that's exactly what's happened. And not only is there the database, but they're coming for people's guns. And so people in New York State who have a psychiatric history have effectively lost their Second Amendment rights, which is, you know, a really big problem. But I'm wondering, you know, based on what you said, what would happen if the front page of the news for the next, you know, or for as many times as Kendra Webdale's murder was highlighted on the news, what would happen if Michael Blair's murder was highlighted as often? Would that change public perception about the ways that we should be spending taxpayer dollars? And that's one of the reasons why I think it's important that we all are out there talking about not just these five people who lost their lives to psychiatry, but all of the people, and trying to get it as mainstream as you can. And that requires competing against the mega pharmaceutical industries and all of the professions that are garnering all of these tax dollars from this. And that's not even counting like private psychiatry or cash-only psychiatry, right, which are whole other, you know, pools of issues. But within tax-funded, you know, what's supposed to be supports, when we know what works, we've known what works for centuries, and certainly with evidence for decades, and they don't provide that for people.
I'm looking there. I see where Michael Blair's mother is at a press conference, and she is speaking up about this happening. I didn't realize he was only 26 years old.
Oh, yeah, he was 26 years old.
And, you know, I mean, they thought they would, people say all this all the time, is I want help for my quote-unquote loved one, you know, my person, they committed suicide and they died. And this is a case where you probably have to weigh, do I call the police because they're suicidal and the police shoots them, or what? It's a terrible choice that the mental health system has advocated for the police and has put other people who love somebody in that situation.
It's really terrible, and they dehumanized us so much that there isn't even a thought for any bit of our humanity or any kind of attempt to engage in a respectful, meaningful kind of manner. And
this is what they didn't want to call the police because they were concerned that if the police came, they would not handle the situation accordingly, and it would have a dreadful outcome. That was what the spokesman for the Blair family said. So they continued to call, and then they were told again. They were calling mental health numerous times. Call 911. The worst thing they ever did was 911 to help their loved one who was having a mental health breakdown. So the family members continuously called 911. This is from the Memorial Examiner. I think this is just so sad to have someone in crisis like this, and you're pleading with the system to come and help your loved one, and they tell you to call 911, and you know it's not going to end well. You have to have that gut.
And you have it so much that you set up a hidden camera, and then when people see the video, the people in power who see the video, they say that it's called justified.
The trauma that this family
is going through, and his friends.
So you know they shot him a lot of times because the smoke detector went off.
Right.
So they
right.
had enough.
11 times. Within what? Like 2 feet? 3 feet? For a knife?
It's unclear from the footage whether Blair came at the officer or tripped over the bathtub wall.
But after he had been tased multiple times.
After the first couple shots ran out, Blair can be seen falling to the ground. The video captures the deputy firing a total of 11 shots, most of them while Blair was on the ground. A woman identified as Blair's mother, for those that have not seen the video clip, screams off camera, "Oh, my God, Jesus, Michael," as the smoke detector began to beep. So, you know, that's high-velocity ammunition, and it sets off a smoke detector. The deputy appeared to attempt to resuscitate Blair, cursed, then told the family members to leave the house. He paces back and forth for a few minutes, looks at his hands, then leaves the screen. The tape shows cold-blooded killing of a young man who was in dire need of mental health therapy. The man needed a prescription, not a bullet. Well, I don't necessarily agree with that.
Well,
but
yeah.
He didn't need to be shot 11 times.
He sure as hell didn't need to be shot. Go ahead.
I mean, so much so that a smoke detector went off.
You know, I've had this video queued all day, and I debated whether or not to play it on the show because people really need to go watch this video because it is the most horrifying, as an example of what a justified shooting is in Texas. You hope that this is some isolated incident that's going to get corrected and people are not going to be allowed to call this kind of thing justified. You know, because it's really not. I just want to say, if anybody wants to call in, the area code is 267-521-0167, or you can call in through Skype. There are two callers on the line also. I don't know if you'd like to talk, but if you would, please feel free to jump in.
How's it going this evening, ladies?
Good. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. This is Mike working. I'm sorry. I'm playing with my mixer board at the same time. Hey, I'm sorry, but I'm listening to your conversation, and I just watched that video, and it's a bad deal. But the problem with that is the way the cop did that was definitely way overkill. Too many rounds, way too many shots. That situation. I mean, you see what the guy did? Look like he's coming towards the cop. The cop should never been inside that room in the first place. You know what I mean? So the cop walked into the bathroom. See what I mean?
To tase him. Right.
Right.
While he's holding a gun. Tasing him while he's holding a gun.
Right. But here's the other problem when it comes to this, though. The problem is when the person called the police, okay, when they called them, and the 911 dispatched to the vehicle to go to that house, they told the car that they have a call for service, okay, which a lot of people don't understand what that means, okay. Police officers are licensed. Each one has a license, okay. That means they're independent contractor, and they don't even really know that. That's the truth, okay. Police departments are separate businesses compared to the rest of the city. Everybody thinks they all belong to the city. That's not true either, okay? So, what happened is this man has a weapon. Anybody has a weapon, it's justifiable if they're not controlled to shoot them, okay? But in the rule book, what they're saying is you're supposed to shoot them to stop them from doing it, not kill them, unless they are a definite threat to kill you. You see what I mean? And I don't think this guy was definitely a threat to kill the police officer. He's more or less a threat to himself, okay? But the cop seen opportunity, and he took it. He enjoyed what he did. You see what I mean? Now, the problem is where people don't seem to understand where the problem comes between mental health and normal people, which they go and drug all of us and keep us all on some type of depressant or whatever. So the pharmaceutical companies keep making their money like they've been doing for years. The guy should have been more justified and had more professional care, because the problem's going to be for the police officer. This man has any mental condition in the past, it's going to go against the cop for shooting a mentally, you know, a person with a physical mental problem, you know. And the cop will be probably considered liable, regardless of what the state says. You know, it's like you were talking earlier about, you know, talking about constitutional rights. Forget it. You don't have those no more. It's not allowed. That changed back in 1871, how much you're on history. You know, I think about the Act of 1871. That's when our constitutional rights and your Bill of Rights went to shit real fast. So, you know, look that up. 1871, Act of 1871, see what happened. I'm a history buff. I'm a guy in your chat room, Ron Reck. I'm also a show host, and that's what I talk about a lot, you know, stuff like this law and the criminal cartel that runs our country. It's sad. It's a sad, sad deal. But they would more or less see somebody dead, a mental patient dead than alive, so they don't have to say pay for it, okay? Because you notice a lot of your big state mental hospitals, they don't exist no more. They shut them all down, lack of funding, lack of logs. They don't really care. If they're crazy, just do away with them. So what do they do with them? They send them to the state prison system, which is another private little business we all don't know about too much of. I was ACA, American Correctional Association, private corporations, big time. They want to keep them beds full. That's why you have so many laws, which are acts. An act is an act. Like a plan school, it's an act. But if you look up, you know, like I said, it's been taking all that explains to you, but look up the Act of 1871, and that will explain to you in detail what I'm talking about, how we all start.
Well, the fact is that I just want to say something that it's a good thing that we don't have large institutions anymore like that, but what it is, it's a failure of the mental health system. And instead of spending more money on judicial process, other interventions that are helpful to people, I don't know why we have to wait until people are in such a state that they're barricaded in a bathroom or whatever. If you have a family member or something that you know is having an issue, we don't have enough of these other interventions like peer support, like people that go out and talk to people. There is no case in which we've had these killings, whether it's by the police or even if there's been some violence perpetrated by the person, that would have been solved by having the person forcibly get an injection, and that's in most cases that's what happens. I've seen this firsthand at our where that's what they do. They inject the person. So you have to have a long series of treatment, and in this case and in others, what happens is the mental health system fails to respond. They offload this to somebody else. And if it's temporarily, even if they come, unless the person is getting consistent help, if there's some peers or something else to help the family along the way, this won't happen. We had an instance here just 30 miles from here in Baltimore where a young man took a car and he went into a local Baltimore station with a car and rammed it in. The news reporters were interviewing him, and I know you can see this online, his mother, and they said, well, someone was to pick him up to take him to the therapist, which led me to believe, I don't know this for sure, that he must have been in treatment already, and it must have been one of the intensive services for them to pick him up, like ACT or something. So I think having large institutions to repopulate themselves is not going to help. People just have to respond. When there's a psychiatric emergency, it is a bad policy for the mental health system to pass that off to the police, because as you said, sir, they get a call for service, and the police, mm-hmm. they're not the fire department. Fire department,
no.
For me, would be
right.
A better person to call because
right.
they have medical training.
Right, and there we are, corporation, right?
Each one of us are corporations. That's the sad part about that, too. Your birth certificate makes you that.
Well, they make lots of money. They're corrections incorporated.
Right. Well, see, but you understand something. They make more money of putting a person in prison than they do in a mental hospital. It costs more money to put them in a mental hospital than it does a prison. You know what I mean? That's what they've done. They do. It's, like I said, you know, mental health, it is not taken serious like it should be at all. They don't look at it that way, you know. It's like they used to say alcoholism was a disease. Now they're saying it's not. You know, so they change the rules as they go along. Because they're a corporated business, United States corporation. It's not the United States. Not people, oh, it's of America. No. You're missing the whole concept of what I'm trying to explain to a lot of people. It's United States is a corporation on its own. Of America. Get of America. The country is called America. Not the United States. It's called America. Matter of fact, I had an argument with somebody one time. I said, well, you know, here's the deal. You know, I'm not a black person, and I'm not an Indian, okay, or anything like that. But it doesn't matter what color I am, if I'm born on this soil, that makes me a Native American, period. You see what I mean? And, you know, it was argumentative, but, I mean, it's a fact. The birth certificate is what makes us the fictional person that we're not. But that's the same gun. It's all part of the scam. You know, we back money. We are what gold used to be. We used to back, you know, gold used to be the backbone of money, and now we, the people, are that. We are the collateral.
But I think that there's definitely a lot of truth in that in certain ways, and it's a lot of argumentative in other ways. But I think either way, anybody who is here is subject to this, and psychiatry isn't a science. There's zero evidence of any biological anything that is happening. There is no blood test. There's no brain scan. There's nothing. And so the pharmaceutical industries are also reaping massive profits off of us, and they've got society duped that they have some kind of answer that's literally, mm-hmm. you know, killing us. And so I like to talk about, like, the Eli Lilly business plan of where they give people mm-hmm. Zyprexa that causes diabetes and then also sell the diabetes pen. You know what I mean? Like, they don't care if we live or die, and if we're not making them money, that
right.
they have no desire to have any involvement with us. And since
well,
one of
know,
the major factors of people getting psychiatrically labeled is their economic status, because of
right.
either institutional, structural racism, classism, gender, you know, go on and on and on. But the economic
mm-hmm.
reality is what the problem is, and trauma,
right?
And
profit.
And all kinds of traumas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Actually,
profit.
And, yep.
Right. But the saddest thing as far as mental health goes that really burns my ass is kids with attention deficit disorder. That is the biggest bullshit story I've ever heard in my life. You know, these kids are spoiled rotten little brats. They throw tantrums. So you gotta drug them down. So now look at the kids that have been shooting people in school. The school shootings. Let's go there. Now, you know, most of them kids were ADHD, as they said. You know what I mean?
Were what?
Okay. They were ADHD.
Wait, most of those kids were what? Oh. Well,
ADHD,
yeah, they were all drugs. And the
what's
Prozac,
that?
The antidepressants.
Right.
The SSRIs.
Chemical them up. That's right. Chemical them up. Okay. And it's a profit game. Most of these kids don't need these drugs at all. You know, they come out looking like, you know, you go into a psychiatrist, they put them on a prescription, they start walking around like zombies. Okay? Now, the thing of that is the after effect when they grow up to be adults. How are they going to be able to react, being chemically induced by this, you know,
No, they're creating a lifelong patient where these people are going to wind
right.
up dying at 30 or 40 years old. God only knows what kind of drugs, the Ritalin,
right.
it's the same schedule as cocaine, the
mm-hmm.
antidepressants, there's a black box warning, it causes people to commit suicide, or
mm-hmm.
and, you know, suicide is anger turned inward, homicide is anger
mm-hmm.
turned outward, it's the same thing,
mm-hmm.
and then senior citizens, and then
mm-hmm.
the electric shocking, and the skin shocking, and the aversive,
mm-hmm.
restraint, seclusion, it is...
Right.
Such a disaster of what we're doing. We're tearing children away. And then you have people like Jaffe on Pete Early's blog saying that it's a myth that people with a psychiatric label can ever work productively, so investing any kind of money into education or training is pointless. And
mm-hmm.
so you have these kids growing up who are being doomed to a life of poverty and
uh-huh.
you know, trauma that are then could be contributing, you know, who knows what with their gifts and skills and creativity. And because they can't, you know, keep 40 kids in an overcrowded room with an education system that is based on absolute flawed logic, you know, to,
right.
to sit straight and look ahead. And it's mm-hmm. and it's infuriating. Oh, it makes me so.
Well, you know, Lauren, the bad thing about this is, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, where is this coming from? We didn't have all these kids with ADHD 20, 30 years ago. Why is it? If anyone say, why is it suddenly exploding? I think Robert Whitaker and his book about the
Anatomy of an Epidemic, yeah.
Has explored this. I mean, it's like we didn't have this before. And all of a sudden you have an explosion in the number of people who are disabled. And it's because there's a lot of money to be made. You know how much money is made if you say, and the idea is they always say the person was off their medication. If you're saying that the person has to be on this or some other medication for the rest of their life, I mean, every person that they induct into whatever means necessary, either by voluntary coercion, by commercials on TV, or by AOT, or by just lying. That person, how much is each person worth to a company once they have known that?
You brought up a key point there just a second ago, ma'am. When you said the excuse they used, they were off their medication. Okay, now that does bring up a good situation here, okay? Now, so what that would really be saying that, and I don't think it's ever been looked at, I'm going to do some research on that topic, though, on this, but here's the deal. Okay, they say he was off his medication, that's why he flipped out. Well, could that be a side effect of the drug he was on causing him to flip out?
That's the bigger
that's a
problem.
Good question.
and that's,
right. That's a real good question.
Yeah.
I mean,
and we can't get the FDA. Right, Yvonne, people have been trying for decades to get the FDA to start acknowledging this question, and they just won't do it.
Well, one of the biggest things I don't understand about ADHD is that, or like I said, if there's a really illness, many people have vitamin deficiencies. There is a serious amount of evidence that if for a lot of these people, maybe not everyone, you know, nothing is ever 100%, but if you give them magnesium, and I'm a person that can swear by that 70% of people in the United States have vitamin deficiencies. And many people, especially children, have vitamin deficiencies because they are not eating whole foods anymore. They're eating potato chips, fast foods, even the meals that help, supposedly a mother is supposed to be able to fix dinner in 30 minutes or whatever. It really takes doesn't take any
dead
more time
food.
To make a meal from scratch.
You're talking about dead foods we're talking about. Dead food.
About what?
Dead food, it's called. Food that ain't got no good value, no value to it. In other words, you don't get no vitamins, no protein, no nothing. Like McDonald's,
many people
chips,
have,
trash.
Many people have vitamin deficiencies because they're not getting the proper food. Everything that they have, if they go to the grocery store and they're buying packaged goods, it has a lot of chemicals in it. It's queuing them up.
GMO is the number one thing now.
It's queuing them up for that. You know, it's like you never have. If you go to a fast food place, If you go 6 months and don't eat a hamburger, and you, all of a sudden you eat one of the fast food hamburgers, all of a sudden you're hungry. Even the next day, a few hours later, you want that because they put additives in there that make you want it. It's chemically induced. The same thing with kids. If they wanted to really help with some of the things that they supposedly call a mental illness, if they would give the parents nutritional training, that would be much better. But they don't just get the prescription medication. This stuff is put in our food. If you go to a supermarket in the United States and you go to one in, let's say, France or in Europe, and you see the amount of packaged goods that we have, if you go to any grocery store now, the majority of the food is packaged with additives. You have to go around the edges to get fresh fruits and vegetables. That's a small department. Even the meat, everything has something in it. So we don't think of it that way, but we've been queued up to have substances in our bodies. We didn't have 25, 30 years ago. We didn't have these children with all of these different illnesses. How can you say you have someone 2-3 years old and you're saying that they have schizophrenia or they have, even if you believe in that, how do you, there's no, like you said, Laura, there's no test for it. Even the people that have the brain scans, you cannot definitively say that a person has this or that. It's only through observation.
It's such a fraud. It's the biggest fraud that's ever been committed. And, you know, when I was locked up when I was 15 in 1988, it was not as common. I mean, it was still happened much too much. But it was not as common as it is today. And now they have even, like, the prodromal schizophrenia of, like, you know, pre-onset of where they're drugging children to prevent this thing called schizophrenia, which has never been proven to exist. And so it's infuriating that the general public has been so fooled by the advertising schemes and the power of the state to control people. And nobody realizes this is a multi-billion dollar industry. And literally, like in New York State, over $4 billion a year is spent on public mental health services. And tax dollars that could be spending to $4 billion infused into the communities of New York State. Could you imagine what that could do for local communities?
And the medical profession has been co-opted as well. And they know it. They've been co-opted.
Oh, they're complicit, yeah.
And they are saying, and even when they say the studies, you know, most studies on most of the pharmaceutical medications are done by the pharmaceutical companies themselves. There are very few studies that are done by universities or private. Even the ones that sometimes are done by universities are underwritten by either like Stanley Research or someone else that is really not independent. In fact, I was surprised to find out that most of the reviews by FDA is done by one company.
And what kind of? I'm sorry. What's that?
Have you seen the latest thing the FDA just approved?
What?
What's that?
It's a real good one. Microchips and pharmaceutical pills. Microchips. And they approved this. Believe it or not, they actually did approve it. And what it is, here's what the story is on this. I went through the website, looked at all of it. It's what it is, just to let your doctor know that you're taking the right amount of medication at the right time, which is a bullshit story, I hate to say, but it is. So, now, what I brought up at the time, I talked about this, and I said, here's the deal. think about all the people that buy street drugs, pharmaceuticals, which is one of the biggest deals around. You know, people love pharmaceutical drugs. What is it going to happen when these people buy the drugs on the street? They eat 10 different pills from 10 different people, and they go to the doctor, and the doctor's getting phone calls from 10 different pills inside of this one person. Well, you know what they'll do? They'll arrest the person for having the drugs. That's what they do then. So it's
right, because they're in your body, right? Yeah,
right. Yeah.
Well, that's a funny thing. This guy that died, that was 300 pounds, that his family members didn't know he had. And I'm going to see if I have it back and send it to you, Lauren. That was what he claimed. He went to a, I'm referring to earlier in the broadcast where I said that in Washington, D.C., a gentleman, and I just characterized him as being 300 pounds, the police was called. He had went to a community center to ask for help. He had claimed a shipment. So we've had for years, people have claimed that they've had chips, and people, they use that as a red flag of saying, well, when they say that, we know he's in the mental case. So by you reporting this, I guess that could be true. But we do have, I think they call them Vegas. There are people that have things implanted in their head.
The Vegas nerve stimulator, yeah.
Vegas nerve stimulator and other things. So when people make comments, I'm just saying this because we have probably a wide audience call. When people make comments like that, it's not that they're talking out of space. There are people that have had things put in them. It is not necessarily all in their mind, but they have been put in them. Although for the life of me, I would not want something like that I couldn't take out. And recently someone said, well, maybe if some of the more draconian things come about and we have a kind of like 1930s scenario, if Murphy Bill comes along, maybe we'll get tattoos. And I had said, well, I don't think they'll give us tattoos. They have biotags and other things. And you just pointed out that they have something like this, they can monitor what
everything.
And I don't know how efficient that even would be of what medications are you're taking or how effective it is on the brain. And all this stuff just scares me.
It makes Dr. Moreau's Island look like a foretelling of our future. But we are, as a society, so screwed. Sorry to be so despondent. But
And people don't realize that to be them. I mean, you don't have to have necessarily mental health diagnosis. I remember another conversation this week. Someone says, where is this notion of one of every four Americans having mental health issues or having mental illness come? And you have to understand that sometimes when people count people like that, they're counting anyone that goes for any kind of help. So if a person goes for grief counseling because they lost a child that was sick or grandmother died, maybe they took medication, maybe they didn't, maybe they went for some help for a few months. They're all put into that same lump. So almost anyone could be said that, you know, you need treatment. I mean, does a person need treatment 2 months after they lost someone and they might be still grieving? Maybe or maybe not. Why would I want to have a judicial process where they might say, we think it's for your good that you take these chemical substances? Now, we know they've been known to lead to weight gain. You know they can lead to sexual dysfunction with some people. But we think it's for your benefit that you take this or that you go for some other things. And this is the thing that people don't understand, that it's not just dangerous to people who have mental health problems. A lot of people, they're thinking that, oh, well, we're talking about the guy that's eating out of the trash can that they're talking about you. Because once these things go in place, no one will be exempt. Not a child. I can They will be dispensing them. They do this now. In some schools, children go to the nurse's office and they dispense their medication. We didn't have this 25 years ago. What has changed from 1960, 1970, 1980, 1990? Why is it we have an epidemic of children that are taking drugs? And what's the difference between them taking a prescription drug and them going out and taking one that is the drug dealer has out on the street?
And people don't there is no difference, and people don't realize that whether they're voluntarily or involuntarily taking these drugs, that they cause the same kind of damage, and that they alter your thinking and your perception the same way that street drugs do. And that myth needs to be broken down so quickly. And it's all back to this idea of profit. NWO, I don't know if you're still there, but if you are, this is where the real issue comes in. And anybody who may want to call in, the number is 267-521-0167, 267-521-0167. We're back at profit and all of these state tax-funded systems doing damage to the people.
In the name of billions of dollars.
Right. And calling it help, you know, calling it help.
This is why the ACA, this is why the Affordable Health Care is so dangerous this is why you hit such pushback on it, because one of the measures in ACA says that health care companies, for example, I don't think it applies to pharmaceuticals, but it does apply to the third party people who are the insurance companies, cannot make more than 5 cents on the dollar. And if they did make more than that, they would have to return profits to their policyholders. If you go to a broker or fund manager, they'll tell you right away that pharmaceuticals are good investments. And they have been for the last 20 years. And they're, like I said, they've never met a customer that they didn't like.
And there was a big issue in Forbes a few years back where they were saying, do not invest in pharmaceuticals and the psychiatric pharmaceuticals. This is not going to be good. And so I think that, you know, some business people see it, and at the same time, it's still trillions of dollars that it's being made annually on each of these drugs, and again with the children to really start calling attention to that.
From cradle to grave, and then they're doing it with our elderly people. I just saw an article recently where they suggested for Alzheimer's that people take antidepressants. So they're expanding their customer base from cradle to grave. I think we got somebody else on.
Is somebody else waiting to come in? Hello?
Maybe not. I thought I heard a click.
Hi, Lauren, it's Sue.
Hi, Sue. How you doing?
Yeah, I just want a few minutes to talk, okay? Can I?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, well,
Would you introduce yourself?
Thanks, Lauren. Yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm Sue Clark Wittenberg from Canada, the capital city, Ottawa. I'm a psychiatric torture victim. I'm an activist, and I know Lauren, and I think she does wonderful work. I'm very proud to be her friend. What I want to talk about is that psychiatry, it almost killed me. In 1973, I was 17 years old. I was shipped from the Royal Ottawa Hospital in Ottawa to the long-term care facility called Brockville Psychiatric Hospital because at the ROH, I tried to hang myself, so they said, You're going to the long-term care hospital, Suzanne, my real name. Now, I'll tell you what they did. Dr. Sipes on Ward H, a locked ward, a current ward, he told me, Suzanne, I'm going to give you electroshock through the brain. I said, I don't want you to do that, Dr. Sipes, because it's going to be like frying my brain like an egg. Oh, no, Suzanne, it won't cause no trouble. So I had 5 shock treatments, and on my 5th shock treatment, my heart stopped, and
oh,
I
God.
Had to be revived. So I live to tell about it, and I'm very angry, justified anger, that 17 years old, I was forced to have this electricity bolt right through my brain, stopped my heart, and I had to be revived, almost died, okay? Then I was psychiatrized in the psychiatric hospitals, 3 in Ottawa and 1 in Brockville. I was 17 years old, okay, that I was admitted to the ROH the first time in Ottawa. I was in 3 other hospitals. And what happened to me in 18 years, from 1972 to 1990, I got 13 different types of psychiatric drugs, one after another. And I know Dr. Healy. We did a lot of the emails. He likes electroshock, but he is a drug psychiatric expert. So I sent an email to David Healy. I said, David, I want you to look at the 13 pills I had, and I want to know which of these pills caused brain damage. He said, Sue, 7 of your 13 pills caused brain damage. I was brain damaged by electroshock, almost killed me. 7 of my pills caused brain damage, and now I can't even remember from minute to minute, and I can't learn anything new. So I went to Carleton the University in Ottawa, in 1995, and I had to quit after 3 months because I could not remember what I was learning. I have the aptitude to go to university, but I couldn't learn because I can't remember. And I'm going to tell you something really upsetting to me, that in 1988, I had a peer, a friend of mine, that he was upset in his apartment, acting out. Someone called the police. I don't know who, but I guess a neighbor. The cops came in. They sat on his chest. He was asphyxiated, and he died. This is a little bit emotional for me because I'm emotive, and this is hard for me to talk about. The cops killed a peer of mine, someone I knew. He wasn't a close friend, but someone I knew in the psychiatric survivor movement. And I won't take too long, but thing is why I'm angry. And then I got 15 different psychiatric labels in the, okay, it'll be in the 18 years of psychiatrist. I have diabetes. I believe that was caused when I was taking medication. 1984, I went to Florida, Disney World, with my husband, and I had a message because I could call my messages. Mrs. Clark at the time, my second husband was Mr. Clark, John Clark, call the office quick. Well, I couldn't. I was gone away for a week. I was told I had diabetes caused by their drugs, I'm sure. I didn't know that at the time. I'm on the insulin 3 times a day, lots of insulin, almost 300 milligrams a day. So I cannot contain, and I have a hard time to contain the anger because they almost kill me. That happened to me. So I'm an activist. Okay? But the thing is, Lauren, they're murdering people, as we know. They're trying to kill them off with electroshock and the drugs, a lot of diabetes and stuff. Tardive, the Dyskinesia? And
the tardive dyskinesia, right.
Pardon me?
The tardive dyskinesia and the neuroleptic malignancy syndrome.
And then 100,000 people get electroshocked every year. I am the director of the International Campaign to Ban Electroshock with my husband, Stephen. And 1 to 2 million people a year get electroshock worldwide. We have to ban electroshock. We have to abolish psychiatry because it's bogus, it's harming people, and psychiatry is committing terrible atrocities against psychiatric torture victims. A lot of my peers are dead. Some committed suicide because they couldn't take it anymore. About 15 of my friends are dead because psychiatry killed them. And anyhow, I'm not going to talk too long right now, But, Lauren, you're doing a wonderful job. I like the radio show. And I'm going to tell you, keep fighting out there, my peers, because a lot of us are dying. A lot of our friends are dead. I'm sure, Lauren, you know people, psychiatric survivors that die. A lot of us I know about 15, 20 people each, all my friends in Ottawa who are psychiatric survivors, lost a lot of their friends. So I have justified anger. Go ahead, Lauren.
It is just that's what's justified. The anger is justified. The rage is justified. And Sue, to survive everything that you've survived and to be able to speak out the way you do and to make a difference in the people's lives that you do and the international campaign to ban electroshock, could you give people a website for where they could find out information about that?
Yes. I will give it to them. It's intcamp.wordpress.com.
intcamp.wordpress.com.
Yes.
I'll make sure to get it up on the blog page afterwards.
Yeah, so I'm going to go now. But I was a psychiatrist in 1972. I'm 59, so that's 42 years ago, and I'm still angry as hell. That anger, the rage, will never go. That here I was a girl from upper middle class. My mother and father, beat me. So I was abused 17 years of my childhood. I was abused for 18 years with psychiatry, and I'm not going to quit talking until they put me in the wooden box. I'm going to tell the world the atrocities they did to me and all my peers. And I want to thank you, Lauren, for your work, because you've been working in the psychiatric survivor movement for many, many years. And anyhow, I will talk soon about electroshock next month. Take care, everybody.
Yes, I look forward to it.
And I think you're all doing great work. Okay,
thanks for calling in, Sue.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Thanks, Sue, for calling in and the international campaign to ban electroshock. And I think that this is, of course, another major issue that we look at in New York and elsewhere around the world. In New York,
is Sue going to be on a show with you? Are you going to have a show specifically for electroshock?
Yes, we're scheduling it for early June. I think either June 1st or 2nd, and we're going to do a special show just on electroshock and its history and people who have survived it are going to be speaking out and I imagine that we'll do many shows on electroshock over the course of this show. Existence. I think it's people need to know that it's not only are people not able to give informed consent because it's still an experimental device that's never been shown to have any efficacy or safety. But it's
isn't
also court ordered on
York,
people.
In New York.
In
New York, isn't electroshock one of those things? When you sign off that you're signing a general warrant that they can do electroshock when you go into the hospital?
I don't know if you're signing. I should look into that because I'm not sure if it's under a general clause or not. But I do know that if you refuse it, they take you to court to have it done to you. And so I don't know what kind of voluntary situation that is. If at any point that you say no, they can say, well, we'll make you. And they also use it.
And he said to have a healthy fear of electricity. I've never had electroshock. I've known many people who have had it, and I know only a couple. I know a couple of people that have had something good to say about it, but they covered it by talking about all of their lost memories that they have, and I just couldn't imagine being in a situation where I would have something so strong as electricity go through my brain and maybe not be able to remember my daughter or my parents or something like that. I mean, it is such an invasive procedure that I just can't understand why it would be involuntary. And I look forward to your your radio broadcast, and I'm going to mark it on my calendar that it's the first or second week in June, and advertise it as well, because I think it's something important people need to know about.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm going to get that out soon. And you know, people, just to realize that it's legal to use on children in almost every state, ironically, except Texas, under 16, I think. And so they use it on children. They also, the person, women over 62 years of age are most in jeopardy of having it used on them. So adult homes or women who don't have any family or who are in institutions who are just being shocked three times a week. And I think one of the things that people don't really realize is that it's not just the electric shock, which on its own would be enough for it to be considered, and it is considered a torture and a human rights violation by the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Convention Against Torture, two of them, 2008 and 2013. But it also requires anesthesia three times a week and muscle relaxers three times a week and painkillers three times a week and whatever else other drugs they're giving the person to begin with as a mix for this. And general anesthesia, especially if you're overweight, which many people who have been on the antidepressants or the antipsychotics are because they cause diabetes and they cause a rapid weight gain, anesthesia for people who are overweight carries a high risk of death alone. So you're in double procedures where you're physically at risk of death and serious bodily injury. And then in addition, the memory loss that people have of, you know, where you, I was at the FDA hearings, many people were, and where, you know, you have these psychiatrists saying that it's okay that, you know, 30% of somebody's memory will be wiped out. Like, just think for a second of, you know, well, which 30%? You know what I mean? And we have no way, nor do I encourage them to find a way to try to target it. And then the interesting thing with the FDA, with the actual devices, is that the only people who wanted to lower it to a level 2, which would make it as safe as a pair of eyeglasses or a wheelchair, were the makers of the device and the psychiatrists. Everybody else saw this as something that was really not a good move to lower it. So it's still a level 3 device at this point, because the FDA hasn't taken any action, even though everybody said that, minus the psychiatrists and the makers, that it should remain, you know, off the market until it's able to be proved safe and effective. But to test it is considered unethical. So, there, and since we have an abundance of information of the damage it does, even by, you know, leaders of the early proponents of electric shock, why aren't we paying attention to the science? And I think that's where we keep on coming back to, is that psychiatry is a fraud. It does not rely on science. It does not inform people about what the science actually says. And instead, it generates lifelong patients who can be treated as less than human and doesn't really give people what they need, which is, you know, emotional support and affirmation and validation and, you know, and a means to be able to get the kind of life that they want to get. And instead we have people getting, you know, killed in the name of help. And so I think that, you know, on yesterday's show there were a lot of people who were very positive and talking about hope and things that they've done to get themselves out of the psychiatric system and ways of creating, you know, bringing a soul back into one's body, so to speak, as the gentleman was talking about unified field theory and what it's like to have your soul ripped out of your body. And so having these, for people who may be listening who may not know much about this, I encourage you to go do your own research. Know that people who have been institutionalized and drugged and tortured, you can make it out. You can create a plan to get yourself out of the situation that you're in. And if you're in need of advocacy, or if your rights are being violated, to contact someone contact me. The Talk with Tenny tip line is area code 718-273-8708, and that's 24 hours a day. If I'm not there directly, there is a machine, 718-273-8708. And, you know, to get involved with this global human rights movement for people who are involved with psychiatry, and there are opportunities to do that. The Mind Freedom 2014 Creative Revolution. What's that?
The Mind Freedom Shield.
Oh, the Mind Freedom Shield, yeah. That, if you, as a member of Mind Freedom, you can set up a shield where an alert will go out to all of the Mind Freedom members to write people and do advocacy on your behalf, and to, for a line in to an advocate. And their conference, the 2014 Creative Revolution Conference, Developing and Expanding Alternatives, is going to be July 24th through July 27th, 2014. On June 19th, as I mentioned earlier, there's going to be the 6th annual demonstration and vigil in remembrance of Esmond Green, who was murdered by neglect at Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency Room, and that will be June 19th. And then July 16th to... I'm sorry, July 13th at 6 p.m. to July 16th at 6 p.m., we're going to be having a 72-hour a demonstration at the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Days vigil on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health. We hold this for 72 hours because they can... detain us for 72 hours and treat us to determine whether or not they will keep us longer. And there are several organizational co-sponsors of the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day, and they include the Kent Empowerment Center, Mind Freedom Florida, Mind Freedom International, the International Campaign to Ban Electric Shock, and the OPAL Project. If you're interested in being an organizational co-sponsor or a individual endorser of the events, please contact me. If you'd like to contact the Alliance directly, their 800 number is 800-654-7227. I think that we really need to keep up the fight and keep working on exposing the truth that is out there. I see there's one more caller on the line. I'm wondering, do you want to jump in and say anything, or are you just listening? Perhaps just listening. If you do want to call in and talk, hello? If you do want to call in and talk, the phone number is area code 267-521-0167.
I think, Lauren, people need to know that there's a lot of hope out there, that there are people like Sue, you, myself, and other people that have been on the call, that you don't have to say that you're going to be trapped in this system or in some treatment modality for the rest of your life, that, you know, that... some of these situations we have are dire. I really hate to say that, you know, some of it is because of trauma, some of it's because of misuse, but with support, and I think I want to applaud your radio program. I think that we need to spread the word wide and far about this radio program, because there are a lot of people out here who are isolated, who think that they're really by themselves, and that they just wonder, is there anyone else that thinks the way that they do? And I just want to say, if you're listening, that this is just a small number of people who think this way. People can and do recover from whatever, whether you want to buy into the mental illness or trauma or whatever else, but people do recover from the trauma of the mental health system, but whatever abuses that they've had in their life, that life does get better. And it's the support that you have in your community. It's the family that you develop. And I say that family is not all people that are related to you. They are people that care about you. And I'd encourage people to tell people about this radio broadcast that is occurring. How often are you doing the broadcast, Lauren?
Almost every day. We're trying out different times. Yeah, almost every day, usually 9 to 11, unless I screw up scheduling, which I'm sure this is not going to say.
I know that I found out about your broadcast on Facebook, but can you give us your hashtag or Twitter or whatever so people can keep up with or either if they don't want to make sense?
Absolutely. My Twitter is at Lauren Tenney, and it's Lauren 10E, 10E. The blogtalkradio.com /talkwithtenney. And my Facebook is facebook.com/TennyLauren. And Tenney is spelled T-E-N-N-E-Y. With the exception of Twitter, where it's the number 10 and then the letter E.
But I know that if you put your name in Twitter, that you're the only Lauren Tenney, I think.
There's a couple out there. I sometimes wonder what they feel about sharing the name. One's in a band too. Lauren Tenney and the Terribles. If you're out there somewhere, I would love to talk with you someday. I'd love to hear about that band named Lauren Tenney and the Terribles. And then there's also a Lauren Tenney who's a dancer. So I'm the one that identifies as a psychiatric survivor. And, yeah. So I think that this is so urgent that we educate people and that we get people. And one of the reasons I really want to do this show is to give an independent voice in the media for people who may not be able to speak the truths that they want to speak in the way that they want to speak them because of other circumstances that they find themselves in. And so the more of us that are speaking out and that we are heard, the more likely it's going to be that we're going to be able to affect change. I know that the archived blogs have already been downloaded over 1,000 times. And in total of the shows, and I think there are 5 shows, or this may be the 6th show. And so it is getting out there. And if you're contemplating calling in and wanting to talk and wanting to share your story and why you might want to do that or not do that, you know, many of us put ourselves out on the front line with the hope that we're going to be able to make some real good change. And it can be emotionally frustrating, and it can be scary sometimes to share your experiences, you know, on the air or even in person with somebody. But to know that you're not alone, and that there are many of us who have gotten out and where we can connect and connect people where you are locally, hopefully, and be able to create a whole new way of seeing things. And I think that when we start to when I was told by George Ebert, who is a coordinator of the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance 20 years ago, that it didn't have to be like that forever, in, as you know, taking all these psychiatric drugs and you know, living the life of a mental patient, I grabbed on to that and I held it and I haven't let it go, and he was right. And so I think that for many of us, just hearing the message that there's another way of looking at these things, and as a society, to start really holding people accountable for how it is that they're interacting with people who are psychiatrically labeled is imperative, because there are just too many of us dying and not being able to contribute to society. And I think that we have a lot to contribute.
And it's more urgent now that I think because of some of the draconian laws that are proposed, like the H.R. 3717 Murphy bill, that we come together and make sure that there aren't further intrusions and further taking away of our liberty. Because, you know, up until, well, right now it's still possible that people go in and get some kind of, they may just pass through the mental health system. You know, there are people that they pass through. You know, they may need help for 2-3 years or even less. And, you know, there are many people, as Whitaker says in his book, that don't really, they don't identify as being a psychiatric survivor or a mental health patient. And when you talk to them, it's, oh, yeah, they were in the mental health system maybe for 5 or 10 years, and then they got out. And there are lots of people that are survivors, but they're not, you know, identifying themselves as such. So they're not the, you know, they're people that have survived, and they're not looking back. And I applaud people like you, Lauren, that, you know, we have these experiences that we have. People ask me, why do I do what I do? And I say, it's because there are still people that are hurting. There are still people that have been taken advantage of by the system. And then, of course, there are new customers that the psychiatric industry are targeting because of the huge amount of profits. And they don't know, because we say, oh, this person has gone to school for 20 years. They have not just a high school diploma, an undergraduate degree. They have, you know, medical school. And who am I to say what they're saying is wrong? But you do have the right to question what is about to happen to you. You do have the right to refuse these interventions that can help, that can hurt you. And you, even if you choose to have an intervention, you do have the right to have informed consent and know just exactly what the risks are that are involved in whatever intervention you may or may not choose to take. And I just say that many people don't realize that this might all go away, and for some places, it doesn't really exist. I think the one of the earlier callers talked about our rights being, you know, taken away or been slowly eroding. And, I mean, it's like Nazi Germany. You cannot all of a sudden just not pay attention and then wake up one day and find out they're coming after you. And you say, how did this happen? Why did I not know? And I think that the Tenney Show is really the Paul Revere in this country of letting people know what's out there, what's happening. We're dying from chemicals. We're being shot by the police. And it shouldn't be. I mean, it's almost as if there's an exterminator out there trying to go after us. And we have to be careful. We have to be knowledgeable about the laws in our state. We have to stand up and fight the coming about of new laws that may cause even more encroachment into people's liberty and into their life. It's not even a matter of getting a matter of liberty when you talk about someone being shot to death and it being seen as justifiable because their family called the police and they did not respond. It's, you know, I think most people think that unless a person is in the grips of a life and death situation, that you should have the right to tell your doctor or someone else that you don't want a particular treatment. But we're in danger of losing that. And in some places, people have already lost that.
That's right. And too many places, too many places. And so we have less than 60 seconds left. Yvonne, I want to thank you again for a great conversation. And anytime you want to come back or do something specific and set something up and do you know, a good promotion around it, please let me know. I think that everybody out there, thank you for listening. Thank you for calling in and talking and chatting on the chat line. If you have something that you'd like me to cover, please get in touch with me. Area code 718-273-8708. We will be on tomorrow, I believe, 9 to 11 p.m., and I will be getting that out soon. And
Eastern Standard Time.
Yeah, 9 to 11 Eastern Standard Time. And I want to thank you all for talking and keep on talking. Until next time, talk to you later.